Prior to the end of World War II in 1945, the Supreme Court seldom issued constitutional opinions involving schools. But what decisions in that domain might have lacked in volume, they more than compensated for in significance. In its earliest decisions exploring the Constitution's relationship to schools, the Supreme Court addressed crucial topics that would, in various guises, become perennial features of its docket: the desire to maintain racially segregated schools, anxiety regarding the school's role in fostering cultural assimilation, and the ability of schools to mandate that students conform their behavior to educators' expectations. These momentous early opinions can usefully be divided into three distinct categories that unfolded in rough chronological order. The first set of cases involved two different race-based claims that are most naturally understood as arising under the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. In 1899, the Supreme Court in Cumming v. Richmond County Board of Education refused to find that a Southern school district's decision to discontinue its high school for black students violated the Constitution, even though the district continued offering white students access to high school. 28 years later, the court in Lum v. Rice refused to find that Mississippi constitutionally erred by assigning a student of Chinese descent to the town's black school rather than to its white school. The second set is a trilogy of cases, all decided during the 1920s, where the court relied upon due process considerations to strike down legislative attempts to assimilate various minorities by regulating non-public schools. In 1923, the court in Meyer v. Nebraska invalidated a state law that prohibited all schools, including private and parochial institutions, from teaching students in languages other than English prior to high school. 2 years later, the court in Pierce v. Society of Sisters determined that Oregon could not, consistent with the Constitution, eliminate private and parochial schools to ensure that assorted minority groups would encounter non-minorities in public school settings. Another 2 years after affirming the legitimacy of non-public schools, the court in Farrington v. Tokushige invalidated Hawaii's effort to impose onerous regulations on private language academies in an effort to purge them. The final set of opinions applied the First Amendment to a pair of cases challenging the expulsions of Jehovah's Witness students for refusing to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. In 1940, the court upheld measures requiring that all students recite the pledge against a challenge under the First Amendment's guarantee of free exercise of religion in Minersville School District v. Gobitis, which prompted the Mount Kisco eruption. 3 years later, however, the court reversed course on this question, determining in West Virginia State Board of Education v. Barnett that the compulsory recitation measures violated students' First Amendment right to free speech. While each of these opinions merits attention in its own right, the broader arc of the Supreme Court's early involvement with schools also deserves notice. These decisions evinced an increased willingness of the court over time to interpret the Constitution in a manner that prevented states and educators from exercising unfettered authority over schools and students. In the first set of opinions, the court demonstrated no willingness to interfere with the race-based assignments of public schools, as the court expressly contended that education was an inappropriate sphere for regulation by federal officials. In the second set of opinions, however, the court's traditional aversion to invalidating educational arrangements began to break down, as the court repeatedly held that legislators overstepped their bounds by exercising undue control over private and parochial schools in the name of promoting cultural assimilation. Finally, in the third set of opinions, the court embraced its responsibility to vindicate the constitutional rights of students within the nation's public schools by recognizing that expelling students for refusing to participate in patriotic rituals cannot be squared with the nation's commitment to free expression. These three phases should not, of course, be understood too mechanically, as this historical development occurred in tentative fits and starts, not in a seamless procession. Some of the transformation, moreover, is a product of historical happenstance, To take the most glaring example, it would be foolhardy to believe that the court would have eliminated segregated public schooling if the issue had arisen in the early 1940s. Despite these caveats, the broad trend lines are both discernible and consequential. As the court's rising constitutional involvement with schools during this period nicely anticipated the intricate relationship between the federal judicial system and the nation's educational system that has emerged in more recent decades.